Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. American democracy is rigged, but not in a way that Donald Trump and his acolytes like to whine about. Our system of representative democracy, this government, it has it baked into its DNA a bias for minority rule. They have an advantage. The Electoral College is one example in the selection of the president. And then there's the U.S. Senate giving all the states the same amount of political power in the upper chamber, regardless of population size. That directly cuts against the concept of one person, one vote. So these were crafted, though, by the founding fathers as compromises in order to cobble together these states and create the United States and the country that we have today. But a new book, Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It, argues that the nation is facing the founding fathers' minority rule on steroids, and we're one election away from a permanent and absolute minority rule that could favor white Christian nationalism. We're joined by Ari Berman. He's the author of Minority Rule. And Ari, welcome back to The Source. It's great to have you back in our air.
Hey, David. Great to be back. Thanks so much.
So the idea that we have minority rule in the United States, it's right there in the Constitution, that's not up for debate. It's just a matter of fact. But the question is this getting worse? And could we be facing absolute permanent minority rule?
Well, I think it is getting worse if you look at the numbers, and I'll go through a few of those institutions. You look at the U.S. Senate, for example. James Madison, who was in many ways the architect of the Constitution, was a huge opponent of the idea of giving each state the same number of senators regardless of population. He said it would allow a more trifling minority than ever to control the body. But at the time, the largest state, Virginia, had 13 times the population of the smallest state, Delaware. Today, the largest state, California, has 68 times the population of the smallest state, Wyoming. So minority rule in the Senate has gotten a lot worse since 1787. You look at the Electoral College. Only three times in American history before 2000 had the winner of the Electoral College lost the popular vote. It happened twice in 16 years in 2000 and 2016, and then it almost happened a third time in 2020. So that kind of thing, in which there's a gap between the Electoral College and the popular vote, is getting worse. You look at the Supreme Court. For the first time in U.S. history, five of six conservative judges were appointed by Republican presidents who initially lost the popular vote and confirmed by senators representing a minority of Americans. So things that might have been an exception 200 years ago are now becoming the norm. And in that sense, minority rule is getting worse, even as the U.S. system has become more democratized. And I think the fear of a second Trump term is that minority rule could be more difficult, if not impossible, to reverse, because the radicalization of the Republican Party against democracy has become so extreme under Trump, and a second Trump term would be all about retribution, retaliation, and cementing all the counter-majoritarian advantages that Republicans already enjoy.
But the argument that you lay out is not just about the flaws of a minority rule on steroids, but also who is the minority and what they want to rule, how they want to rule. These would be white Christian nationalists, people who support MAGA, people who support Donald Trump. And they were re-ruling against multi-ethnic democracy. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, when I'm talking about minority rule, I'm not talking about minorities as we tend to think of them, which is historically marginalized or disadvantaged communities. I'm talking about an elite and powerful conservative white minority, the people that are opposed to multiracial democracy, that are people that are opposed to the changing demographics of the country, the people that are opposed to America one day becoming a majority minority future, something that's already happened in Texas. And if you look back at the Constitution, the founding fathers were concerned about a very specific minority, which was themselves. They knew they were a distinct minority, and they wanted to preserve the rights of white male property owners, many of whom were slaveholders. They didn't really care about the rights of minorities as we tend to think of them today. They didn't care about poor whites. They didn't care about Native Americans, African Americans, women. Those were not the people the government was structured for. So I think this idea of minority rule goes all the way back to the founding in terms of preserving the power of powerful as opposed to vulnerable minorities. And I think that's the same kind of minority rule that the right is trying to preserve today.
So how do we see right now the impact of minority rule preventing the will of the people, the general population? What's being stifled?
Well, I think broadly popular policies are unable to become law. You know, 80% of Americans support things like reasonable gun control laws, or similar percentages support things like access to abortion, reasonable limits on restrictions on voting, things of that nature. And those kind of things don't become law. And then unpopular things do become law. We see things like Roe v. Wade overturned. We see things like the Voting Rights Act gutted, the system flooded with dark money. And a lot of people are unhappy about how we hold our elections. 80% of Americans want to abolish the Electoral College. And that would make sense because 80% of Americans' votes don't count in the Electoral College. It's a small handful of swing states that will determine who the next president is. And so if you're a Republican in California, your vote doesn't matter either for president. Sort of similar like how if you're a Democrat in Texas. I mean, I know Texas is becoming more competitive, but everyone knows Texas is going to go red in 2024. And so in that sense, I think a lot of people want popular policies to become law that aren't becoming law. And they also want the system to become more fair in a way that it is unfair today. And I think Texas is a great example of that, because the demographics of Texas and the politics of Texas are totally at odds. You have a majority-minority state in which people of color are by far the majority in terms of younger citizens, but you have a state Republican Party that controls the state at all levels that is overwhelmingly white, older, and conservative. So the politics of Texas are totally at odds with the demographics and many of the policy preferences of Texans. And I think that's one example of how minority rule is playing out at the state level as well.
All right, I got to get to this break right now, but when we come back from this 1 minute break, I want to ask you more about minority rule in Texas, particularly as it works in the primary system with the Republican Party, also about moving forward new laws that have been put in place in Texas that are attacking voting rights, could nullify the votes in places like Harris County, which is the largest county in Texas and happens to be a very blue county. So when you say everyone knows that Texas is going to be red in 2024, maybe it's because, as we said, democracy is rigged. Anyway, the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you want to get in on this conversation, we want to hear what you got to say, 833-877-8255, Minority Rule. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, speaking with Ari Berman. He is the author of the new book, Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. He's also written the book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He is the national voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones. And you can call in, ask a question, give a comment, 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. So Ari, in Texas, it's been 30 years since a Democrat was elected to a statewide office. We have, this Republican regime firmly in power here, and the primary system keeps them in power, but only 15%, maybe 20% of the voters in Texas actually have a say in who becomes a statewide office holder because of the primary system. Can you talk about that?
Well, there's just so many ways in which democracy is constricted in Texas that makes the state a lot redder than it otherwise should be. One of those is the primaries, because the state is so gerrymandered at the legislature and because so many elections are decided in the primaries, a much more radical element, even within the Republican Party, let alone in the state itself, is dictating the direction of the Republican Party, and by virtue of that, the direction of much of the state. Then you just look at the voting laws themselves. Texas is one of the only states in the country that doesn't have online voter registration. That's so crazy to me in this day and age that you couldn't register to vote, for example, on your phone. And that means that Texas has 3 million unregistered voters, which is larger than the population of many, many states. And that means that those unregistered voters are predominantly younger and voters of color. If they were registered and if they voted at the same numbers as the rest of the electorate, Texas would be a very different state. And then to register voters without online registration, you have to be deputized to be able to do it. You could have to be deputized by the state every 2 years. You can only register voters in counties that you're deputized in, meaning to do a statewide voter registration drive in Texas, you'd have to be deputized in 254 counties every 2 years. So Texas is intentionally making it difficult to vote through its voting laws, through the fact that the state is so heavily gerrymandered in the favor of Republicans, through the fact that so many elections are decided in the primaries alone. And so I think the politics of Texas are very much out of step with the demographics of the state. Texas is a majority-minority state, so it's a preview of what the rest of the country is becoming. But the politics of Texas looks like the state did 30 or 40 years ago. It hasn't caught up to those changing demographics. And in many ways, the state has been structured to prevent those changing demographics from having a real say in the state's political future.
Well, in the primary system, we talked about that just earlier, but it's been an open primary system. So maybe, Democrats are tired of voting for candidates that can't win in the general election. Maybe they'll go across a no vote in the Republican primary. And now Republicans in Texas are saying enough of that. They want to close the primary system. You have to become a registered Republican in order to vote in their upcoming primaries. This is something that they're talking about doing. They haven't done yet, but it looks like this is going to be happening. Do you think that's even going to push Texas even further to the right?
Yes, because Texas is already being pushed further to the right. They just had primary elections in which a bunch of people, I would hesitate to even call them moderates, but a bunch of people that are more moderate-leaning in the Republican Party lost. And so what happens is, if you're a Republican in the state legislature, for example, you're constantly looking over your back. The people that tried to impeach Ken Paxton, for example, which a lot of which had nothing to do with ideology, it was just about the fact that how corrupt he was, they faced primary challengers. If you buck the governor, like we saw in the last legislative session, you don't want to basically turn public schools into Christian schools, then you might get a primary challenge. If you start talking about like gun control in the wake of Uvalde, then you might get a primary challenge. God forbid you were for abortion rights or for voting rights or said climate change was real or any of those things that a majority of Texans actually believe, then you're going to face a primary challenger. So the Republican Party just gets pushed further and further to the right. As a consequence, Texas politics gets further and further pushed to the right. Now, I think at some point, if the Republican Party becomes so far right, it creates an opening for the Democrats to be able to win in Texas. But with a few examples, it's been very hard for Democrats to be competitive in Texas because it's such a big state, because it's so expensive to raise money for statewide races, because there's such a small pool of Democratic elected officials, because the voting laws are so restrictive, it's hard to bring new voters into the process. For all those reasons, Texas should be a place where Democrats have opportunities, but frequently they don't. And then when they get into power in places like Harris County, then the Republicans statewide try to limit the power of those areas.
So talk about that, how there's a new law in place that would allow the Secretary of State of Texas to essentially nullify the votes in Harris County if they suspect that there was some hanky-panky going on in the ballot box.
Well, it gives it eliminated the position of election administrator in Harris County. And secondly, it gives the Republican appointed Secretary of State the power to potentially order new elections there if it finds what it believes is evidence of fraud. Now, this is extremely concerning because this law only applies to one county in Texas. And that county happens to be the largest blue county in the state. So it's extremely rare. I mean, I've been covering voting rights for over a decade now. It's extremely rare for one county to be singled out like this, let alone a county with so many people that is indicative of how the state is changing politically. You just want to look at how Texas is changing. You look at Harris County. That was a county that was reliably red that has become much bluer. And that's what Republicans are afraid about. The cities in blue, as you know, in Texas are blue right now. So Texas essentially has blue cities in a red state. And that is really concerning to Republicans because people are moving to those cities. And so while some areas like the border might be getting more conservative, by and large, the state is trending in a more liberal direction because people are moving to more liberal areas. And the places that are growing in Texas are places like San Antonio and Dallas and Houston and Austin. And those cities are spreading into suburbs and exurbs that are also getting more competitive politically and also changing demographically. Places outside of Houston that were 90% white might be majority minority now. And so that is, I think, is the demographics they're afraid of. And they're doing things like writing legislation specifically to single out those counties to try to exert more control over how elections are run and ultimately elections are certified there.
So imagine in November we have the general election and the Democrat Colin Allred manages to squeak past Republican incumbent Senator Ted Cruz, and now there's a general panic in the state. And could they just, you know, go claim that there were shenanigans in Harris County and have a redo or just, you know, prevent of Colin Allred from taking office?
Well, I mean, you'd like to think that there'd need to have some sort of showing, some kind of evidence to be able to do that. And I think I forget exactly how the law was written. I think people were concerned that it was written in a needlessly vague way, but I think there had to be some kind of benchmarks of fraud to be able to show it, because Republicans have begun to contest elections in Texas and in which outcomes they've lost. And so there's a precedent for trying to do it, but I think they would have to find some kind of actual finding of irregularities other than we didn't like the Democrat.
But I mean, but their standards are so low and they seem to be able to just invent things out of thin air.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I was going to say is that, I mean, we already saw what they passed at the Texas GOP platform, right? That you would have to not just win the statewide vote, you'd have to win a majority of counties. Well, a majority of counties in Texas are very small, very red, and very rural. And so that would basically give the smallest county. There's counties in Texas that have like 900 people. And so that would give a county with 900 people.
And there's no real basis in law or tradition for something like that. And that was a proposal by the committee, but doesn't have the impact of law.
No, it's not going to become a law. But I'm thinking those are the kind of schemes that you're going to hear more about if Democrats start winning in Texas.
Yeah, I just didn't want to confuse anybody who was listening who would thought, oh, that's what they're going to do.
Sure.
Okay, that's not what they're going to do.
No,
that's
I'm not saying
some
they're
people would
do
like
it.
To see
it obviously,
happen.
it got a lot of attention. It's not going to become law, I don't think, anytime soon. But the fact that they're raising it, I mean, listen, we've seen other crazy ideas raised by Republicans in Texas. People say there's no chance that's going to happen, and then it becomes law. So, I mean, when they start doing things in Republican circles, I think you at least have to pay attention to that. And then the people that want to moderate policy, you know, like the Speaker of the House, they're always on the verge of getting pushed out and replaced by more extreme people. So I do think that they would try to fight back. Democrats are going to have to break through somewhere, though. And I think it's only going to be a matter of time before they do, because the gap between the demographics of the state and the politics of the state can only be manipulated for so long. I know people are keep waiting, and you've heard this for over a decade now, that Texas is at a tipping point. So I'm hesitant to say that it is, but I think that at some point it becomes difficult to prevent the shifting nature of the state from having any impact on the state's politics. I think you can only do it for so long, but I think clearly in Texas, they're trying to forestall the impact of those demographic changes for as long as possible.
I'm going to get David, a caller, on the air because he's been waiting a long time. David, thank you for waiting, and now you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Well, I've been in the same house my wife and I bought since 1987. I want to mention first off that we've been gerrymandered twice. After the 2000 census, we got shifted from 20 to 23, and after the 2010 census, from 23 to 21. And you look at the shape of the voting districts in Texas, and they are absolutely insane. That's number one. Number two, I'll just say I used to vote mostly Republican in my younger years. My first vote was for the reelection of Tricky Dick. We knew how that turned out. But I'm absolutely fed up with the Republican Party for supporting things that are obviously, excuse me, lies. I just can't believe it. But I believe that we ought to go to a nationwide popular vote, ranked choice voting system, so that third party candidates can actually, you can actually vote for a third party candidate as your first choice and not feel like you're wasting your vote. And get rid of the Electoral College completely. If we can't get rid of the Electoral College, make every state apportion their electoral votes according as closely as possible to the popular vote.
All right, David, thank you for that. So the Electoral College, how that selects our president, Ari Berman, any way out of the Electoral College?
Yeah, some really good points raised by the caller. The first is that there's two ways to try to get rid of the Electoral College. One would be through a constitutional amendment, which is very difficult because you would need two-thirds of the Congress and three-quarters of states to do it. Now, that said, we almost actually had a constitutional amendment in the 1960s abolishing the Electoral College. It failed because it was filibustered by Southern segregationists who argued that it would give black voters the same rights as white voters. So we actually weren't that far from abolishing it in the 1960s. But the other way to abolish it, not through a constitutional amendment, is through the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which is basically states that equal 270 electoral college votes, which is a majority, pledge to appoint their electors to the winner of the popular vote nationwide. And right now, that has 209 electoral votes behind it. So it's not going to happen anytime soon. I'm sure if they did get to 270 votes, it would be challenged before the Supreme Court. But that said, there is a movement to try to abolish the Electoral College that isn't through a constitutional amendment, and it is picking up votes. And they're only 60 Electoral College votes away, which sounds like a lot, but I think is closer than they are to trying to abolish the Electoral College through a constitutional amendment. And I think that what the caller said is basically the sentiments of most Americans, that I think that most Americans don't like the Electoral College because most Americans have their vote excluded from really mattering because of this system. And we're the only advanced industrial democracy that elects our candidates this kind of way, through a system in which you can actually get a minority of votes, but end up occupying the highest office in the land.
And now that we've seen how these fake electors went about trying to subvert the Electoral College vote, it should even create greater suspicion and maybe some motivation to fix it or junk it, find something else to do with it. Direct popular rule, perhaps. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll come back with more Ari Berman after this break. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The book we're talking about is Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. We're joined by the author, Ari Berman. You can also find him in Mother Jones. He is the National Voting Rights Correspondent. His previous book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. So let's talk about the U.S. Senate. This is had been called by some of the founding fathers as the cooling saucer of American democracy. They didn't want things to get too hot with the popular, sentiment. You know, some populist comes along and excites everybody, and we have an upheaval. Now we need something to keep things cool and steady and stable. Don't rock the boat too much. But things have gotten kind of out of hand, you write, with the so many smaller states having as much political power as states like Texas or California, larger states. We have small blue states, Rhode Island, Vermont, Delaware. Why isn't that a problem?
Well, I think the problem is not that it just favors smaller red states. It's that the smaller, more rural states tend to be more conservative in general. But I think that the problem is not that the Senate is biased towards red states so much as it's just biased towards places where people don't live, because the gap between large and small states is growing so dramatically that the Senate is becoming increasingly out of step with America. By 2040, you're going to have a situation where 70% of Americans are going to live in 15 states that elect 30 senators, meaning that 30% of the country is going to elect 70% of the Senate. And that's going to have a hugely detrimental effect on people in places like Texas and in places like California, where people are increasingly choosing to live. And the interesting thing is that many of the founding fathers wanted to prevent this kind of situation. James Madison, probably the most prominent founder at the Constitutional Convention, said that he wanted the Senate to be an elite body, that cooling saucer, as you say, but he wanted it to operate on the basis of majority rule. He believed that the Senate should be based on proportional representation. And indeed, the first plan for the Senate that was passed at the Constitutional Convention was based on proportional representation. The problem is that the small states basically said, if you don't give us the same level of power as the larger states, we are going to leave the Union. We might actually join France, which is about the worst thing that you could say in 1787. And so it was an example basically of hostage taking. We call it a compromise, but it was much more of a concession. And Madison was very unhappy about this at the time. He said it was going to give what he called a more trifling minority than ever the power to control the balance of the power in that body. And things have become dramatically worse in terms of the unrepresentative fact of the Senate, because in 1790, the country's largest state, Virginia, had 13 times the number of people as the country's smallest state, Delaware. Today, California, the largest state, has 68 times the population as the country's smallest state, Wyoming. So the fears that Madison had about the Senate have become dramatically more magnified today.
Well, we have the filibuster as well. So does that magnify this disproportionate allotment of power?
Yes, because you already have a situation in which the Senate is biased towards wider, more rural, more conservative areas. And then you have the fact that when it comes to the filibuster, that just deepens the counter-majoritarian bias of the country, because in the last Congress, you had 41 Republican senators who represented just 21% of the country who were able to block things on issues like gun control or voting rights or abortion rights that were supported by 70 or 80% of Americans. So you have a very small minority that's able to block policies that are broadly popular. And so I think that the structure of the U.S. Senate and then the way it operates, I think, is a case study for the problem of minority rule. And of course, the Senate has an outsized impact because Electoral College is based on representation in the House and the Senate. So that skews the Electoral College. And then, of course, senators confirm Supreme Court justices, so then it skews the Supreme Court as well. So we're seeing that these distortions in one branch of government, they also affect the other branches of government as well.
So the Senate has the power of the responsibility for confirmation of presidential cabinet appointees, also for judicial appointments, including for the Supreme Court. So how does this, balance of power, the fact that smaller states have just as much power as larger states, how do we see that impacting, the Supreme Court and other judicial appointments?
Well, I mean, you've seen it affect the Supreme Court very clearly, because for the first time in U.S. history, you have five of six conservative justices were appointed by Republican presidents who initially lost the popular vote and confirmed by senators who represented a minority of Americans. So the Supreme Court is also a product of minority rule. And it also didn't just happen in the normal course of things. There was, of course, hardball tactics that got us to this place, like Mitch McConnell, the Republican majority leader at the time, blocking President Obama, who won the popular vote in the Electoral College, from appointing Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court 8 months before the election, but then allowing Donald Trump, who lost the popular vote and would lose it again, to confirm Amy Coney Barrett 8 days before the election. So, I mean, the Supreme Court was a product not just of an undemocratic Senate, but of undemocratic actions by that undemocratic Senate. And then, of course, those justices have then made the system more unfair by doing things like gutting the Voting Rights Act, flooding the system with dark money, upholding partisan gerrymandering, doing things that are at odds with public opinion, like overturning Roe v. Wade, and even going so far as to protect Donald Trump, it now seems very likely, protect Donald Trump for even being able to be held criminally liable for inciting the insurrection before the election.
And maybe even make the president immune from all prosecutions, regardless of how terrible they are, the crimes. So what are some solutions? Do we really need two Dakotas? Can we put them together and have one Dakota? Can Maine be forced to go back to Massachusetts? Should Texas split into five states? Why not?
I mean, it is funny to think about this because you laugh, but I mean, there was one Dakota, and Republicans just split them up because they wanted four senators instead of two. So, I mean, we're not joking when we say this. I mean, they quite literally created North and South Dakota so that they could have more representation in the Senate. But I mean, I think one thing that would be make a lot of sense right now is to make Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico states. And that would at least make the Senate more reflective of the country. Because, I mean, the argument for not having Washington, D.C. as a state is crazy, because Washington, D.C. has 100,000 more people than Wyoming. But not only is it the center of the government, but it has no representation in Washington. And so, I mean, I think that's something that could easily be rectified, and that would start making the Senate more representative of the country. Puerto Rico is another place. You could talk about the other U.S. territories. There obviously are more radical ideas. But I don't think that people should be penalized for choosing to move to certain places. And it seems like that's what we're doing. We're basically saying, you know, if you decide to move to Texas, if you decide to move to California, you're actually going to have less power. And you think it should be the opposite. You think that the places where people are choosing to live should have more say over how the government is run, but instead they have less say. But changing the overall structure of the Senate is going to be very, very difficult, because one of the last things they did at the Constitutional Convention was they said that essentially you can't change the representation for any state without that state signing off on it. So that basically gives the Wyomings and the Dakotas of the world veto power over changing the notion of equal representation in the Senate.
Well, so we have the Congress, House of Representatives, and that's direct proportionate to a population size. And that was created as they were supposed to balance each other out. We have the lower house, the upper house, Congress and the Senate. Has that tension between the two, does that no longer exist?
Well, first off, the House, even though it was the only Democratic part of the government in 1787, the only part that the people actually directly elected, it wasn't perfect either, because the slave states said, we need more power in the House, just like the small states got in the Senate. And so they came up with a three-fifths clause, which basically said slaves are treated as three-fifths of a person, but only for purposes of representation, which gave the southern states a third more seats in the House than if they would have had otherwise. And of course, the Electoral College was based on representation in the House and the Senate, which meant that the slave states had a lot more power to choose the president than the free states did. So that was a problem with the House from the beginning. Now the House is more reflective of the people, but the House can also be manipulated through things like gerrymandering at the state level. So Texas's delegation is a lot more Republican than it should be, because Texas Republicans drew not just the state legislative districts, but the state's U.S. House districts. And the amazing thing that happened in the last census was nearly all of the population growth in Texas came from people of color. But white Republicans actually gained more seats in the legislature and in the Congress as a result of the maps that were passed.
And this is after a deliberate undercount in Texas.
That was even after fewer people were counted in Texas through the census, because the census was so marred by efforts to add a citizenship question and also just difficulties with counting people in a pandemic as well.
And the state refusing to fund a full count effort.
Yeah. So, I mean, there were a lot of problems with the census that affected the count and census. But even with the count, all of the growth basically in Texas came from people of color. But those areas where people of color were living did not get increased representation. What happened is the increased representation instead went to more Republican areas. And therefore, Republicans were able to pick up seats in the legislature and also pick up seats in the U.S. House. And so I think that while the House is theoretically more Democratic than the Senate, things like gerrymandering still make it skewed relative to what it could be.
And now we live in a world of weaponized social media and disinformation, and that seems to have really added the crazy to the mix in the House. We're going to take a break here. JD, I see you on the board. I'll get you on the air right after this break. Our phone lines are open. If you got a question or a comment about minority rule in the United States and in Texas, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're speaking with the author Ari Berman. He's a national voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And his new book is Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. Let's go to JD on the phones. And JD, you're on the air. Go ahead.
How was Mitch McConnell able to block President Obama and then allow Trump, his judge, to come into office?
All right, JD, thank you for the question. So how did Mitch McConnell pull that off, keeping Barack Obama from appointing getting his appointment to the Supreme Court?
Just because he could. I mean, it's really simple. It was raw power politics at its rawest. I mean, they controlled the majority in the Senate both times. And so Mitch McConnell just invented a rule that you can't appoint a Supreme Court justice in an election year, which was a totally invented rule because many Supreme Court justices had been confirmed in an election year. And then he completely violated that rule to confirm Amy Coney Barrett right before an election. So it was just because he could, and it was bare-knuckle politics at its worst. I also blame Democrats for this because Democrats, I think, should have fought much harder to get Merrick Garland on the Supreme Court. First off, President Obama picked Merrick Garland because they thought he would be a moderate that would be palatable to moderates and conservative senators. That didn't actually work. So maybe they should have picked someone that the Democratic base should have rallied around. Then they should have done whatever they could to try to get that person on the court, including potentially exploring putting a justice on through a recess appointment. They didn't choose that. They basically said, oh, well, Hillary Clinton will be the next president and she'll be able to appoint the next Supreme Court justice. And it didn't work that way. And so this was one of the most consequential events in modern American history, because there was going to be a 5-4 moderate to progressive majority on the Supreme Court if Obama was able to appoint Merrick Garland for the first time since the 1960s. Instead, it became a 5-4 that then became a 6-3 conservative supermajority on the court. So that decision by Mitch McConnell had a huge impact on the course of American history.
Let's talk about how minority rule, if it becomes absolute and permanent, which is what we're looking at in this next election, how does that impact daily life for most Americans, the vast majority of folks, particularly people who don't fit into the pigeonhole of white Christian nationalist? You know, this having a minority rule, does it, for example, does it weaken the rule of law? Does this weaken the fact that there should be equal justice for all under the law? Does that suffer?
Yes. I mean, I think so many basic democratic norms and so many things that we take for granted, like freedom of speech, like freedom of assembly, like freedom of a religion, could be curtailed. I mean, if you had a extreme reactionary conservative white minority that, as you said, was very much rallying around the banner of white Christian America, that could curtail lots of rights for people that don't fit into that paradigm. And I think things like the overturning of Roe v. Wade that people thought would never happen would become more normalized. I think that Trump would use the levers of government to go after people that don't agree with him, to go after his political opponents, to go after civil society, to go after protesters of his policies, all of those kind of things. I think you'd see his policies being rubber stamped by the Republican Congress, by a conservative Supreme Court. I mean, I think a lot of people are thinking, well, we survived one Trump term, why would a second one be so bad? And I think a second Trump term would be more dangerous because I think Trump himself has become a lot more radical. He's become a lot more retaliatory, focused much more on retribution. And then the Republican Party has become a lot more extreme. People like Liz Cheney, Mitt Romney have basically been purged out of the Republican Party. So the old establishment have now been pushed out of the Republican Party. The Bushes, you know, the pillars of the Republican establishment, the Bush family and their supporters are basically all now never Trumpers. And the fact is, not only that, but there's a whole apparatus in the conservative movement that has a 900-page blueprint through Project 2025 of what they want Trump to do. And these are very, very radical things, things like weaponizing the Department of Justice against Trump's enemies, deploying the Insurrection Act on peaceful protesters, purging the federal government of nonpartisan people and putting in radical ideologues instead in everyday positions. I mean, I think this would affect people's daily lives in ways they're not really thinking about today. And so I think from that standpoint, I do think that a second Trump presidency would be a lot more dangerous than the first one, even though I think the first one was pretty damn bad from my perspective. And then also, I think that the institutional capture of the government could be a lot worse if Republicans were to control all three branches of government and then would take actions that would deepen and entrench their control and authority over these kind of institutions.
Well, we just had a couple of Congress people say how great Jim Crow was. Yeah, it was great for the African-American family. You know, when you have a demographic that loses their political power, they cannot vote, they're not being allowed to vote, they're being kept from the vote through voter suppression and through violence and intimidation and murder and lynchings, then they also lose all their other power. And they become victimized economically and everything else that, and they're not allowed to have equal justice. I mean, this could be a catastrophe if we have portions of the population, including women, who are no longer going to have a voice in government.
Yeah, I mean, that was an astounding comment from the congressman from Florida, Byron Donalds, who is black, that life was better for black people under Jim Crow when they were lynched, when they were beaten, when their voting rights and other economic rights were taken away for nearly 100 years. I mean, it was astounding. And I have an entire chapter on my book called The Gerrymandering of History that talks about how history is weaponized so that we can't have an honest conversation about our past. And I think we've seen that at pivotal periods. There was a weaponization of history after the Civil War to promote Jim Crow, and we're seeing a lot of that resurface today to try to preserve white power at a time when the country is changing demographically. And so I am really concerned about that, that people would even say stuff like that Black Americans were better under Jim Crow. And I do think that we're at a hinge point where the question is, do we want to embrace multiracial democracy or not? And we've had these conversations before, pivotal times in our nation's history, after the Civil War, during the Civil Rights Movement. And at times the country has embraced multiracial democracy, and at times it's walked away from it with really catastrophic consequences. And I feel like we're at a similar moment today. And so to me, the election is not really about Biden versus Trump. It's really about, do we want to embrace multiracial democracy, or do we want to turn our back on it and embrace a form of authoritarianism that isn't really democracy at all? To me, that's much more the choice of the election than a choice between two candidates. That I understand that people aren't crazy about either of them, but the choice in the ballot is much bigger than these two people.
How would this impact the economy? Particularly the innovation economy. I remember when we used to have Ma Bell. There was one big phone company in charge of the entire nation, and they really charged you a lot for long distance phone calls. It was just very difficult and hard to work with. And then there was determined to be a monopoly, and they broke up Ma Bell. Because of that, we had this telecom revolution, which eventually brought about the internet that we enjoy today. If we don't have, because these were, if we have a minority rule, then you allow the billionaires to decide what becomes allowable or not in America. The petro state becomes enshrined in America. How does this impact and prevent innovation in the economy and improving people's lives if we have minority rule?
That's a really good point. I think that what would happen was the corporate consolidation that a lot of people are worried about would get a lot worse. And essentially, a corporate America would have carte blanche. They could do whatever they want. And their influence on the political process would grow exponentially. And therefore, they would be able to have a lot more say over people's everyday lives. And so people would have less choice in general. And, we're already seeing that with the media. We're already seeing that with consumers and companies like Amazon. We're already seeing that in lots of different aspects of American life. And so you make a really good point, which is that minority rule doesn't just affect the structure of institutions. It affects people's everyday lives in terms of how they live. And I think people don't often put two and two together. They think these debates over things like the Electoral College or the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, they think we're just arguing about politics. You're just saying this because you're a liberal.
They think these are these really elite good government conversations that are really disconnected from people's everyday lives. But what I'm trying to say is this affects your everyday life. This affects the bread and butter issues you care about. This affects the fundamental rights you care about. How our government is structured and who controls it affects how you live your daily life. And I think one reason people often don't vote or don't care about how democracy works is because they don't see the connection between government and their daily lives, and they don't think it really matters. And so I think that if we can draw more attention to how decisions by the government and when the government isn't reflective of the country, what that means, if we can actually try to get people to understand that, there's a better chance that they're going to want to participate and then want to try to change those institutions for the better.
Right. If you think your vote doesn't matter, if you think it's all rigged, if you think it's just, that you don't want to get involved in politics so you don't vote, then you've been voter suppressed. Ari Berman is the National Voting Rights Correspondent for Mother Jones. His new book is Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist. It's always great to have you on our air, Ari.
Really appreciate it. Thanks so much, David.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.